This is deep dish, right?
Yeah, well, let's get deep.
So I'm going deep on both sides.
Lindsay, welcome to the platform. How you doing?
So good. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I'm excited about this conversation, and just one kudos to you, a whole bouquet of flowers to you for just all the work and effort and energy and thoughtfulness that you put into our community here in Nashville. And so I don't know how many people officially just randomly thank you, but I want to thank you because I know it's not easy. I know that you don't wake up every day just ready to go all the time, you know. And so a bouquet of flowers to you and just all the work that you have done, going to continue to do to help build just a better Nashville and better communities for all of us who's living here. And just thank you.
Well, thank you for saying that. We do it together, right? We do it in community.
Yeah, so. For sure. Street trapping activist, nonprofit leader, mom.
Another one coming.
Congratulations on that. And just, you know, being a woman in the South, in Tennessee. Grew up in South Carolina. Take us through that process of, like, growing up in South Carolina and kind of maybe what motivated or moved you to do the work that you're doing today?
So I grew up in the foothills of South Carolina. We have a small airport, Greenville-Spartanburg. Some people have heard of it. And, you know, I grew up in a very small town, very conservative church, and it was very closed-minded. Mm. It was a community that took care of each other really well if the each other part looked like us,
right?
Or acted like us. And when they didn't, there was a lot of exclusion. So I learned both community care and community exclusion from the community I grew up in, at church, basically. And at some point, I knew I had to get out. It was probably late in high school. I grew up in a Church of Christ community. I'm now recovering, even though I have deep respect for some people in that community still and the community itself. I'm in recovery, and I, you know, I knew about Lipscomb and Nashville. I had visited Nashville before, and something about the bigger city, the more open-mindedness, it just called to me. And, you know, I was part of, in my family, we had folks who had experienced incarceration, who had experienced homelessness, experienced severe mental health issues, and devastating substance use disorders. Mm-hmm. So that was something that was really familiar to me. And I really wanted to get out of that, run from that kind of past. And I always grew up thinking that those kind of issues were all about personal choices, mm-hmm. right? That's what society, that's what school, education, everything kind of instilled in me. But when I came to Nashville and started seeing some bigger picture things in the city and started getting a liberal arts education, and understanding the way systemic poverty works, mm-hmm. and then rereading some of the prophets in my own tradition of faith, and being like, they're badasses. Oh my God. Why didn't we talk about them in church, right?
Right.
We talked about what not to do in church a lot, not the radical prophets. So that kind of shifted things for me, right? Mm-hmm. And we could talk more about that, but those kind of things moving inside of me and then falling in with, I'll say, the right and wrong group of people, like the Nashville Homeless Power Project here accidentally, they really blew up in my mind and heart.
And so I want to pivot back to, like, when you was in high school, right? How did you know? Because, you know, most of us grow up in, you know, our community bubbles and stuff. And I think still today, one of the most divided racially places in our country is church.
Yes.
You know, still, you know, what does it say? Like 12 noon on a Sunday, look around, you can kind of tell America where we still are, right? So I wonder, how did you know, like, this is not right, something doesn't feel right, and not kind of be indoctrinated with those same type of perspectives and thoughts around just diversity and inclusion and welcoming people that may not look like you?
I mean, I was lucky in that I had a mom that really encouraged us to be critical thinkers, wow. really encouraged us to ask questions, really encouraged us to think critically. And then I had a good public education. I went to public schools. I remember in second grade being, our public school expanded. We're in this little trailer learning, and I did my report on Martin Luther King Jr., right? That was the first time I really remember learning about him. But those kind of things were like seeds planted, right? Critical thinking, the things I was learning in public school, and the radical parts of faith that really are there in every tradition under some of the more dogmatic stuff, right. Potentially. Or maybe, yeah, we could think about it even differently than that. But those seeds really grew and flourished, especially when I got here to Nashville.
Speaking of your parents, I was gonna see if they was one of the like main kind of reasons how you were able to not to be all the way influenced by the church, because I'm assuming like this was also the church that their families and they grew up in as well.
Yeah.
And so did they also have some of that maybe we don't welcome them too kind of things, or they have more like kind of openness, or was it depend?
It depended. And, you know, my mom and dad were different. So my dad was an elder in the Church of Christ and very, very true to those teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, an amazing human being. Love him so much. Not as open-minded. He's coming around a lot right now.
Right.
You know, my mom is much more open-minded and has had different experiences in her life. So, and I think, you know, my mom was a woman in the Churches of Christ too.
Right.
When you are excluded and silenced yourself, you have a very different, experience than you do as a white man in Southern church.
Right.
So.
How did your relationship start to change between those that you grew up with, whether it's friends or family, or, you know, peers or what have you, as you started to shift it mentally away from maybe some of the things they were indoctrinated to just purely through church?
Well, I remember, you know, there was a big shift, and it took place for me when I came to Nashville College. But I remember when Andrew, my husband and partner, and I got married, we chose to do wedding vows that were mutual instead of like that kind of more traditional wife submit to your husband.
Right.
And I remember some of the people from our church who came to Nashville for the wedding, after the ceremony, they were like, well, that was interesting. Like, made this big deal to make sure we knew how interesting that ceremony was. And so, and then, you know, they invited me to church in South Carolina to speak, but they couldn't have me speak on a Sunday from the pulpit because I was a woman, so they had a special breakfast. But then they didn't invite us back to speak again. So there were differences, and they started emerging in those years. Interesting differences.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, when I talk to folks about these things, especially folks that grow up in just like culture and family that are so true to these traditional ways, when they tend to like break away, it tends to like fracture some relationships sometimes, because like, no, you shouldn't be doing that. This is not the right way, especially when it's coming from a religious belief or mores and values that is backed by what would be absolute power to them and how they are interpreting particular texts or scriptures.
Yes.
And so I always find it fascinating and just curious, like, what was the breakaway point? Like, how did that switch go off in people's mind? And like, oh, something right here.
Well, I did get accused of being, one of my mom's church friends called my mom up and was like, Lindsay's a socialist. I'm concerned about her. She's a socialist. I mean, you know, not gonna say that's too wrong, but at that point, you know what happened too is during those years, especially after the 90s, right? There's a merging with some conservative religions and the moral majority and the right. And that was happening too.
Right.
So she saw the term social justice that I was participating here in Nashville,
mm-hmm.
and she was listening to Glenn Beck, and she was like, socialism. Well, let's actually talk about socialism in the Bible or something, if you really want to get into things, in Acts chapter 2 and all this other stuff. But anyway, it was it's been interesting.
Right. I'm curious, what does social justice mean to you? Since I'm ready to just kind of get into it. What does that mean to you?
You know, the language I've used has shifted over the years. I think I used to gravitate toward social, economic, and racial justice, mm-hmm. and I still do gravitate toward that language. But for me, there's even a bigger kind of horizon now to work towards, which is collective liberation. Mm. And that's a term that feels, that resonates most deeply with me.
Right.
So even though I'm in the housing justice world and work, that's in the anti-criminalization work, right? Which merges into so many other works. Mm-hmm. The bigger picture that we're working for is collective liberation, which right. is a world where everyone is free from all the chains that are holding them back,
right.
from all the inequalities that are currently plaguing our right. systems and our present.
Interesting. And that sounds great. Unfortunately, what our country has done specifically mm-hmm. is this race thing, right?
Yes.
Which I believe has restricted a lot of that collective liberation that I think we all know. Like, we all want everyone to live, like, in an equitable sense.
Yeah.
But I think race has restricted us so much from multicultural organizing, specifically, because it's like, we know it's all of us, but then it's like us and them type of mix, and then it's like they, okay, we're gonna support the ask of the agenda of this particular group over this particular, like, and then it pits people together, and a lot of that I think heavily is everything else over here kind of get elevated, and then anti-blackness.
That's so true.
A lot of times, from the lens that I see it, but I think like just having the idea of understanding like social justice is liberation, it's a collective liberation for all, like, is what we should be like kind of thinking about, right?
But you can't. You're so right that if mm-hmm. you start erasing some of the racial issues mm-hmm. and other issues that have been so crucial to creating the injustice and inequities that we have, then that's a huge issue too.
Right.
So yeah.
What, like, as a white woman, what has been maybe some of you, like, the growing that you have been able to do, especially getting into the social justice space?
Yes.
Because we all got to go through our growing pains. You know, whether that's, oh, we taking up too much space and not knowing, we're talking too much and not knowing, doing too much talking and not enough listening, whatever it may be. We all, if you started from the, we've all done it at some point in some type of level. And so I'm curious, like, what was some of, like, those stories or moments where you noticed or somebody, you know, came and say, hey, you know, I think you kind of, you know, taking up too much space, or maybe you could be doing more harm than good unintentionally. You have any of those moments that you just specifically remember?
Absolutely. I mean, one comes to mind when Mike Brown was, his murderer was handed the non-indictment verdict, right? Mm-hmm. So, and the whole community here, just, there was just this rage. And a lot of our friends who were organizing, this is before Black Lives Matter had a chapter in Nashville. So this is the grassroots group that is growing from the mobilizations that happened after Trayvon,
right.
Martin and others were murdered. So I remember reaching out to some of my organizer friends in the Black community and being like, what do you need? And they were like, first of all, show up. Mm-hmm. Second of all, keep all the white people off the mic. Third of all, de-escalate all the drunk ass people on Broadway who are going to be like giving us hell. Keep right. us buffered.
Right.
But keep white people off the mic and like organize your people.
Right.
That was such a big learning thing for me, because the voices that we needed to hear were all the voices that have been silenced right. and literally, again, murdered. There are so many people in Tennessee, in Nashville,
right.
who have been murdered by police
right.
brutality
right.
And have been impacted by racist policing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and really understanding that, you know, like, as someone who's interested in anti-racist organizing and racial justice and this broader work, I don't need to just know all the amazing Black people who have worked for this work. I need to know the white folks who have done it too,
yeah.
and study how they have organized their people. Learning about Ann Braden, thinking about John Brown, so many others,
yeah.
learning that kind of history. There were so many like rad Quaker abolitionists, right?
Mm-hmm.
That I've learned about who are white organizing for the abolition of slavery that we are now kind of moving toward as mm-hmm. new abolitionists today,
yeah.
Working for an abolition of policing as it currently stands in the yeah. incarceration system. So learning about their stories too has really been important for me as a white comrade in the work.
Yeah.
But really taking the lead, and I have to do my own work. I was raised by people, white people in South Carolina who kicked Black shareholders off their land to develop it. That is part of my history. And I have to understand that and grapple with it and make reparations wherever I can, talk to my family, like figure out what we can do.
Right.
That is work that I have to do. So I'm learning that more and more, but I'm really grateful for, I mean, there, anytime you're in organizing work, you will make a misstep.
Yeah.
And those have happened. And I'm just so grateful for the friends that have held me accountable and also, also seeing the deep commitment
it's and grace. Love. It's giving some grace.
Yeah, that really keeps us so rooted together
right.
to be working for this. Because we are stronger together, right?
Yeah, for sure.
When we're doing it the work in the ways that it needs to be done.
What did that pushback look like? When, especially when you may be trying to organize, inform, educate white friends, peers, associates, was there any pushback like, I don't think anything is wrong? Have you ever experienced that?
Absolutely. And people talking about riots or something, using mm-hmm. riot language
mm-hmm.
to discuss like peaceful protests after, mm-hmm. again, like police have murdered,
mm-hmm.
you know, people. So it's really about educating them about language. I can't tell you how many. Oh, Facebook, right? Like social media is so hard. But how many personal messages I would send to people and be like, I just want to like share that like, I don't, the way you're talking about this, like, let's talk about that. You know, you really have to, one of the things I've tried to do and model wherever I can is that what Serge talks about, right? Showing up for racial justice, calling in,
mm-hmm.
not just calling out, and right. not just calling out to alienate people and shame them and show how right you are and how wrong they are. Because there's a bump that you get, right, from being righteous and being like, you're wrong, this is terrible. But if you do the work to call in, that can really be transformative. That's what people have done for me,
right.
And that's what I want to keep doing to call people into this work.
So. And I think that's what we need to do more of. Because it's easy to say, oh, you're wrong. But I think it's more impactful and powerful if you can invite that yeah. person in just to even understand their perspective and where that may be coming from.
Yeah.
Because you never know. We all have our upbringings. We all have things that we just don't know how this has influenced us. You know, whether it may be with policing, housing, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If a police saves your life and you're saying, I don't want to defund the police, maybe that makes some sense.
Yeah.
But maybe I don't know the police saves your life part. I just know that you don't want to defund the police. But then if I know, oh, you got saved by some, like, oh, okay, you have a different type of commitment and attachment to that service.
Yeah.
And so I love that idea. Don't call out, call in.
Yeah,
that's a
whenever
t-shirt.
You can. Yes.
That's a t-shirt.
Yes. And there is a time to call out. Let me just say, like,
oh,
there
yeah.
is a time.
I'm all about that.
When you've done your work or when you're speaking truth to power,
right.
there is a time to do that. But relationally.
Yeah.
And, like, defund the police, right? A lot of people don't realize that we're here today in the mass incarceration world because in the 80s, Reagan's administration
mm-hmm.
chose to gut federal funding for housing, to gut social safety net programs.
Mm-hmm.
the war on drugs was going full speed. They invested in broken windows policing in the 90s, right?
Right.
Like all these things happened, and we defunded communities and housing while we funded police and prisons.
Right.
So like when we talk about defund, we're not talking about this radical idea.
Right.
We're talking about swinging the pendulum back to funding the community things that keep us all safe.
Right.
Like education and housing. Right. So so there's some education elements that you get to do when you call in too.
What I had the pleasure of speaking to Theda Murphy on here.
I love her.
true abolitionist, right?
So wonderful.
And so what does that mean to you when you say I'm for abolishment of incarceration, policing? And the reason I ask what does that mean, because what I hear people talking about, like specifically like prison and jail, I think we just have this infatuation with punishment in this country and harm, right? And not to say people should be held accountable, but they're still human beings, right? And I'm still even toying with this personally myself. Do I believe that we don't need prisons and jails, or do I believe that it needs to look like something different, where people can really rehabilitate and become better community members, because 95% of these folks are coming home, right? Yeah. And so what does that mean for you? Does that mean just get rid of prisons and jails and come off with something else, or like, tell me.
You know, I'm still learning what it means to me. So abolition has been something that I've always been interested in, especially after seeing how the criminal the criminal legal system has affected our friends on the streets. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that in the Black community here too, and in the Brown community, and so many other communities. So for me, the idea of abolition, people who were abolitionists during the time of slavery were told that it's never going to happen.
Right.
They were told that slavery is one of the pillars of the economic systems, right, of our country. They were told it's never going to happen.
Right.
But it's this imagination that things can be different and that another world is possible.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many amazing thinkers encouraging people to think about what this looks like on small scale. Miriam Kaba is phenomenal. And there's so many people I'm learning from. But it really does look like on the micro level and imagining what this could look like on the macro level.
Right.
Starting to practice transformative justice instead of punishment, like you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
in our own relationships,
mm-hmm.
in our own organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're wronged, how can we think about what could transform these moments instead of just leaning on that?
Biblically, you know what that is? Radical love.
It truly is.
And I'm trying to practice that. Because I think restorative justice and radical love are the same.
Yeah.
Personally. And I know I have to start within, because I get impulses when I'm hurt and when somebody does something to me, like I shouldn't automatically be thinking like I want to harm them or I want them to suffer. Right. So how do I fix that internally? And where does that come from? Well, you grew up in a country that like perpetuates and conditions you and tell you, from the time you in kindergarten to adulthood, like punishment is the way to correct things.
100%. And you experience that as the corrective, right?
Right.
So like, I mean, I'm a student of history and I understand some of the ways we got to having a country entrenched in mass homelessness and like white supremacy, right? So if these things can be created and manufactured and implemented on such a wide scale, then they can also be dismantled and new things can be put in place.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine a city where everyone has housing.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine a country that funds social services and housing instead of cages, right? And if we can start imagining that and practicing some of those things on a small level and reading with others, studying with others, like working with others to think about what this could look like, you know, the People's Budget Group here. We've been a part of that at Open Table Nashville. really to say, why is Metro Nashville, why is our council, why is our so much of our tax money going to policing when so much of it is steeped in racism and social profiling? When we have underfunded schools, when we have, we're deep in an mired in an affordable housing crisis, right? We want our money to go toward housing and education and community safety in the form of mental health care.
Things that not should policing. Divert
yes.
people from being in the criminal legal system.
Yes. So those kind of things are abolitionists, so right?
Seems so simple.
Those kind of things are seeds of this world that we could create together. And I'm an idealist. Like, I believe that those things are possible.
Not even possible. Like, we have the proof and stats.
Yes.
Like, for people who are not, like, idealists. And if you want to be a realist, there's the stats to prove it. Like, people who have housing, education, are less likely to...
Healthcare
are less likely to end up in jail or prison. We just know that. Yeah. That's like, that's not nothing we just... like fetishizing about, like we know that. And so when we have systems perpetuating these acts that are going to continue not to put people in housing and give them great education and less likely have them being funneled in a criminal legal system, it's kind of perplexing, really perplexing to think about. And
And it's more expensive to lock people in cages than it literally is to house them, than it literally is to provide support services around them. So there's the you're right. The stats are there. The research is there. We've got to change hearts and minds and systems, right? So we're working toward that on whatever scale we can, but also trying to practice it within ourselves. Right, that transformative justice, that restorative justice, and that like spirit of abolition.
Let's talk about the unhoused, right? It's a lot of the work that Open Table does, that you yourself do on so many different levels. Just not a professional, like you're personally entrenched in our community that doesn't have housing. And so I want to break this down of... what does it mean to be unhoused? Because I just recently started using unhoused instead of homelessness. They're just unhoused, you know. Shout out to the contributor too. Just throw that plug in there. Love the contributor.
Me too.
But can you just break that down for us and what that means and what that looks like for our unhoused neighbors here in Nashville?
You know, what I've learned from my friends on the streets, and, you know, Andrew and I have experienced displacement from one of our apartments we rented being flipped into an Airbnb, but we also experienced a tornado, and those were very temporary stints of displacement. But even personally in those tiny little moments, you have the bottom fall out for you. There's no stability. You're in survival mode. You can't think clearly because everything is bent on where are we going to stay? What are we going to do with our stuff? Like, how are we going to keep what we can and have and stay together? What I've learned from my friends on the streets is that it's so different for every single person that experiences it. But I have a lot of friends that prefer, I mean, I was talking to, I had a group downtown with one of my my friends on the streets, co-leads, Terry. We had a group downtown yesterday of students, and we were talking to somebody, and a friend came up, Tim, on the streets, and he was like, it's not homeless, it's houseless. We don't have housing. That's the thing that unites us. But, you know, what I've learned is it's incredibly different for every person. There's always, from what we see, this like thread of trauma that runs through a lot of experiences of being houseless and being displaced. We've seen, oh my gosh, so much survival mode, right? When you don't have that stable place to land, when you don't have housing, when you don't have safety, like even when you're staying at the shelters here, right? Mm-hmm. You're packed in like animals into big rooms often, mm-hmm. That are incredibly crowded. You're treated like you're on a prison schedule. Mm-hmm. And it's so dehumanizing. So many of the elements of being without housing, especially as you go longer and longer and longer, are so dehumanizing. But it's just such a radically different experience for everybody. We've seen so many people turn to different coping mechanisms to make it through. Mm-hmm. When you don't have support, when you don't have community, when you don't have access to healthcare or meds or anything, mm-hmm. And you're being harassed every day, you're mm-hmm. being spit on by people who are passing you or mm-hmm. just ignored and feeling invisible. How do you keep going, right? So there's incredible struggles that people face, but what I've also seen is not only the need and like dehumanization that people face, but also the incredible community that comes together on the streets. And I don't want to use the word resilience too much, because I feel like when people focus too much on individual resilience, it's saying, you know, that person should really be able to rebound from all they've struggled with. And it puts the onus on the person instead of the community to make things better. But there's still so much like leadership on the streets, strengths on the streets, people surviving and taking care of each other in ways that are more radical than most of our churches, synagogues, and temples and faith communities are doing. Yeah. If you think about, like, I have a pantry at home that's full with food. And if I give some of my neighbors some food out of that from time to time when they're struggling, that's giving out of what I, like, an abundance. Our friends at the camps give out of their poverty and need all the time, sharing what they have, the clothes off their back with their mm-hmm. friends. So there's just so much, there's still so much beauty in life.
Right.
Being without housing, though, in America does not need to happen, and it can totally put people in subhuman living conditions. We see people that have built out whole sheds. They've got generators. Like, they've built something off the grid, and they're living well. Mm-hmm. There's so much ingenuity. We've also found elderly folks with severe disabilities, severe health issues, trying to survive a winter in an old refrigerator box, like under a bridge. Incredible need, like with frostbitten feet. Like, we have people dismembered every winter, every summer by living in the elements, right? Literally, I have friends that have lost eyes because of medical oversights, friends that have lost legs because of frostbite, and fingers and so it's just literally people are being dismembered in the shadows of all the progress of Nashville, right?
Right.
And still there is strength and resilience and leadership and love and things that we admire. So it's just very complex.
Yeah. Barriers. What I realized is that I feel like we have services a lot of times that create barriers to help people or to build with people, right? Whether it's you have to have an email address or you have to have Wi-Fi or you have to have some type of technology. Like, it's, I feel like the services that our systems have put in place are also barriers a lot of times. And so I wonder, how do you all try to navigate some of those barriers for the houseless that you all serve on the street?
You said it so well. There are so many barriers. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're creating more barriers. Our whole state just passed a law that makes it a felony to sleep on public property across mm-hmm. the state. Let's talk about creating a barrier, giving people a felony for literally existing when there's not enough shelter beds or housing beds. That keeps people out of jobs. It keeps people out of housing opportunities. So not only do
we're not going to put you in a home. We're going to give you a felony where it actually makes it even harder for you to apply for a residence.
This bill came from people, from legislators in Cookeville and Sparta, who were seeing more people on the streets because of the pandemic, right? And they're like, we want them off the streets. And we're like, this is keeping them on the streets. If you want them off the streets, fund outreach, fund housing, fund all, like, living wage jobs, my God, you know, right to work state, whatever. But gosh, I could go on a whole sentence about that. Maybe we will. But barriers. Not only are we trying to advocate with people mm-hmm. on individual barriers they may have, we help people get expungements, right? Mm-hmm. People that haven't had their documents for decades because they were born on a military base in Japan, we try to help them get those documents so they can unlock doors to public housing and mm-hmm. things like that. We're also trying to dismantle the bigger barriers that do exist, like the laws that criminalize folks.
Right.
We have to do expungements so often because most of our friends on the streets who are at the point of trying to get housing and they've been unhoused for, you know, a few years, they've got trespassing charges, they've got obstructing the passageway charges. We've got to get that off mm-hmm. so we can make them more appealing for housing and employment, right?
How's the communication between you and Open Table with our fine officers of MNPD about understanding criminalizing homelessness, right, or houselessness? Do they share similar sentiments? Are they like, no, we're just throwing everybody in jail that we can pick up and find? Don't see how it benefits them personally outside of like financially, and they can say, hey, budgetary wise, but what's that communication? What are those talks like? Is there communication?
So I wouldn't say we're super close. Metro is not a big fan of Open Table Nashville when it comes to the mayor's office or MMPD.
Really?
You know, we are privately funded, and we are, I would say, if not one of the only homeless organization, like service providing organizations. We also do advocacy and organizing. But we're one of the only service providers that's willing to speak out. We have helped wow. campsites organize when Metro is trying to shut them down. Like when the mayor's office is trying to shut them down, like most recently Jefferson Street Bridge, right? We helped those residents organize, and it stayed open for another year until they finally shut it down.
So talk about. The mayor hold on, let me make sure. I'm just making sure I want to compartmentalize this right. If I'm not mistaken, the mayor's office, the mayor, they just got a like independent housing, like agency department thing, right? Yeah. And they don't want to talk and be in communications with Open Table.
Wouldn't say we're their first place to go.
I feel like if that's the core issue of addressing those who are unhoused or just housing, the housing crisis, right? Like, it seemed like that, even like haters will love us, you know, but like clearly, like, we're bringing issues to the table that exist that this new housing department needs to be aware of to try to remedy the situation.
We're working with the housing department.
Okay.
So we're cool with them.
Okay, cool.
They like us. We talk. We're working together. but, you know, like, you know, with MNPD here, you know, we've been a part of the people's budget. They mm-hmm. are aware of that. Right. We have talked about pouring more money into the community instead of policing. But with, you know, we really try to play an educational role and an advocacy role mm-hmm. when it comes to policing and police interactions with our friends on the streets.
Right.
So we're trying to, we've actually also, one of the trends in Nashville and outreach groups and service providers has been to add police. There's a new quality of life team mm-hmm. in the Nashville police precincts. And they work with outreach workers to go into encampments. Mm. We are not a huge fan of that practice as people who believe in trauma-informed care
right.
And harm reduction. People who are disproportionately impacted by policing shouldn't need to get help through those same people. They should have other people without badges and firearms on them to be able to approach and build trust outside of that. So we've actually been advocating for police to be removed from some of those outreach units and only engage when absolutely necessary, if absolutely necessary. We don't have to call the police that much because we do trainings in de-escalation and, you know, trauma-informed de-escalation and other things.
And I think that's where the community education piece comes in, because a lot of times that's all we know is call 911, right? We don't know any other service to really come and support a situation to de-escalate it that really doesn't need policing.
Yes.
And I say this, like, I don't believe in the such thing of when police come, de-escalation exists personally. I feel like, because I think we all triggered in some way by police, and I think if anything, it heightens the situation. Because people are nervous. You just don't know. Like, police show up, like, you just may feel guilty. You ain't even did anything. And now you're panicking. Like,
power it's, imbalance. Yeah. It's so extreme.
Yeah. And so, they're not. I forgot the number of hours they even trained in, like, real de-escalation, especially with, like mental health type of crises and things like that. It's like, you know, but hey, it is. You know, and I understand that at the moment, more people want policing than they don't want it. And I think that's because we don't know what the alternative looks like.
Exactly.
But it's like, do we have to have them involved in every kind of fraction of our lives? You know, from school to, you know, just trying to just be. You know, and navigate, just navigate them and their presence, because they take up all the space once they arrive. It ain't no other space. It's police space. And it can go left or right really quickly.
In devastating ways.
And so I can only imagine, you know, for a tent camp community, which everybody's just living their life that they have, and just and getting that kind of disrupted and dismantled because, like, of this new law.
Yeah.
And they're not hurting anybody.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Like, they're not. Who are they hurting?
Yeah. So, property values? No. Their property values in Nashville are fine. But that's what, you know, they were trying to sell the lot next to the Jefferson Street Bridge camp.
Uh-huh.
The state was trying to sell the lot next to the Jefferson Street Bridge camp. And that's one of the reasons they shut it down, right? One of the reasons.
So, like, I know when I was working for the Contributor, we would get letters saying that, hey, they believe it or not, there's community members that don't want Contributor vendors,
mm-hmm.
you know, selling the paper and making money so they can have access to EBT, housing, and all those things that the income allows them to be eligible for, right? Is it the same way kind of with Open Table? Do you have people that don't want the Open Table doing the work to help those that are, you know, houseless in our community? Is it subliminal? Is it just straight out just hate mail? What does that look like?
The group that's targeted us the most lately is Reclaim Brookmead.
Reclaim it.
So there's haters out there for us for sure.
You know what they say, if you ain't got no haters, you ain't popping.
Well,
that's what they say.
We have some in Metro and in Brookmead, apparently. So in West Nashville. But we try to work with everybody we can, and we try to build bridges wherever we can. But we also try to be real about the harm that's been done. And you can't tell me that the officers that are coming in to close camps and to enforce, be the enforcement arm of the state and of private property and put all these things before human lives, are also there to build the trust and care for. And, you know, it's just, there's a conflict of interest there.
I had to Google this Reclaim Brookmead Park. Oh. So this is who they are. I have to read this so people can really understand the context.
Okay.
We are a grassroots nonprofit, nonpartisan organization for the sole purpose of reclaiming Brookmead Park from the homeless camp so taxpayers from Davidson County can enjoy this beautiful space of the people living there and can be compassionately housed and helped.
Sounds nice. But it's
Recane Brook Mead Park. That's what they have on their website. And then of course they, you know, got all of these great pictures of, you know, the housing camps of, you know, showing just how people who are unhoused live and have to live. And it's a great, wonderful police officer in the picture looking, you know, poetically.
Yeah, they're tight.
In the view. So yeah, I'm gonna have to invite them on here.
Oh,
I want to understand.
Here's the thing. The news interviews them all the time. They come to public meetings all the time. They're really great at talking. Guess who was the only group to testify for the bill that made it a felony?
The Brook Mead.
Yeah. So they say, want care. We want housing. We want compassion. And then they lobby for the very criminalization tactic. Tennessee has the harshest criminalization law in the nation, making it a felony to camp on public space. They lobbied for it. So they will say whatever they want to come off well. But look at their actions and look at the vile stuff their Facebook account spews. And it's been incredibly toxic to community education on who people that are experiencing houselessness and homelessness really are.
Mm-hmm. How does something like that get passed? Like,
I'll tell you how it gets passed. It gets passed because we shut it down the first year in committee. Okay. 2021, we worked with the contributor and a couple others, and we shut it down. This year, it came back up at the end of the session, and we mobilized. We mobilized Nashville. We mobilized Knoxville, Memphis, Chattanooga, others, people in Murfreesboro. But in Tennessee, you can't just mobilize the blue areas.
Right. You
if you're not doing mobilization in the rural areas, in the rural counties, then you can't win on the legislative end. So that's where we're moving as Open Table Nashville. We're moving to do advocacy on and community organizing and coalition building on a statewide level now, and not just locally, because we have to.
Yeah. Yeah, and Nashville is an interesting place to live in with the congressional maps being changed.
Yes.
And then with the Republicans at the moment having a supermajority at the state legislature. And pretty much they can pass anything they want to pass at this point.
It's so divided.
Yeah.
Damn, so we've got to organize. And that's where we're moving. And that's what we're shifting to right now.
I want to talk a little bit about some successes.
Absolutely.
If you can give us a story or two of some successes of like you just seen, like coming in and just working with a community member that has been houseless and seeing them evolve and transform and be able to get into housing and how that has significantly changed their life or their family's life during that process.
So can I give you two?
You can give me two, three, four. How many? We here for it.
Okay. So the first one comes to mind is somebody that I got an update about this week. So back in 2008, I just started doing this work and fell in with the wrong crowd at Tent City. I met this guy named Papa Smurf, and I write about him in Praying With Our Feet. But Papa Smurf, and I knew him for 6 years. He was this radical, like, hospitality provider. He was a carpenter. He worked with his hands. He had survived incredible childhood trauma, right? But it was 6 years of building a relationship with him before he was willing to really talk about his family in upstate New York, what had happened to him in his life, and how he was medicating some of his trauma that he experienced with substances, and actually willing to address that. It took us 6 years of relationship building. Anybody would dismiss somebody like Smurf as living in a camp and beyond all of that. Today, he is reunited with his family in upstate New York. His daughters are calling him dad. He is a caregiver for his mom. He has been sober 8 months because of his health. Like, he's incredible. Like, if he can do it, I mean, he was like one of the mainstay folks at the camps, like, for so many years. He was able to do that because of the relationships and the trust And the connections. We had a volunteer and a board member who literally drove him with his trailer to upstate New York to see his family and reconnect with them. And now he's there. So, I mean, you know, stability is possible for every single person, and it looks different. People have different goals for their life.
Right.
He wanted to reconnect with his family and still live a good life. And he's been able to do that. And it's just, I mean, you know, I've stayed in touch with him for 14 years now, and he's a dear friend. He has nominated himself as the godfather of our toddler. So
that's rightfully cool. So.
Yeah, I'm like, you, yes, you are the godfather, yes. But
that's amazing.
One other person, my friend Terry, who co-led the student group that we had yesterday with me, we met him when he was under Jefferson Street Bridge a couple years ago. He became unhoused because of the tornado.
Mm-hmm.
He lost his house in the tornado, just like we did. But he didn't, I mean, he didn't have insurance. He didn't own. He was renting.
Right.
He lost his house, and then the pandemic hit, and he lost his job because very quickly, a lot of jobs dried up. So the place he was renting said, "We are not giving you any grace. Like, you're out of here." And he said, "Well, take me to Jefferson Street Bridge." He became a leader in that community. When we helped Jefferson Street Bridge organize against displacement and that closure, he was one of the people they nominated. He's been coming to public meetings with us.
Wow.
He's been leading education events with me. He's now at kind of a transitional housing, rapid rehousing hotel facility,
mm-hmm.
Caretaking for his daughter, who is an adult with special needs, and he is like about to get housing. He is incredible.
That's beautiful.
Like, he is such a leader. And so many people, again, dismiss people that they see as somebody who's needy, somebody who, you know, is deficient, fill in the blank. These friends are leaders. They are. I've seen more hospitality from Smurf than anybody in a church ever, like radical hospitality.
Yeah.
There's so many stories, but, but immediately those are two of the people that come to mind.
What advice would you give people who may easily dismiss those that they may see something, the contributor, camping, or just from their lens may just look like they're unhoused? What advice would you give those people who may have those thoughts or implicit biases that will allow them to just kind of work on that, or just give them a different lens, or give them a different perspective to look at those community members? Because they still are community members, our neighbors, when they see them.
I mean, classism is entrenched in our society too. It's the water we swim in.
Right.
So, one thing I'd say is wherever you can, try to shift that mindset from judgment to curiosity. Really trying to think about, you know, what has that person experienced?
Right.
What has got them here? What is their story? If we can shift from judgment to curiosity, that's a huge first step. And every time we're critical of someone else, every time we have those negative stereotypes, we have to wrestle with those.
Right.
It's classism, racism, all sexism, homophobia, all of those things have common roots, and they have to be interrogated.
Mm-hmm.
So just gently, like, try to shift to curiosity, and that's a really nice frame to move forward with.
And that's why I do this, 'cause I'd be curious. I just be wanting to know. I just be wanting to know, because we all got blind spots, you know?
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, like, working with the contributor, like, just blew my mind. I can't remember the guy's name now, but one day I just asked him. I was just a volunteer. So I'm like, "Hey, man, like, how'd you get in this position?" You know? And this changed my whole lens on, like, how somebody might end up in position without housing.
Hmm.
He said, "You know, man, I got like a mathematics degree from Stanford." I said, "What?" and this is my idea of, like, measuring people based on education. Like, "Oh, if you got a, like, what did, like?" So, "Yeah, man, I just honestly just, I had everything that a person, I guess, materially could have, and just didn't want it no more. I wasn't right, and I just really wanted to live a more simple life and not be in a rat race. And so I gave all that up and I'm selling the contributor and I'm happy. And yeah, that's like, that's part of I said, yeah. That blew my mind. And ever since then, it was like, you never know.
Never.
You can't even assume the life one has lived or could live. It would just, and just making a choice, you know, yeah. A lot of it's circumstance, but some people are just literally making a choice. Like, mm-hmm. Hey, this is kind of what I want to do, how I want to be, and I'm fine with it. And it blew my mind.
And those, if there is a choice toward like living in a certain way, right. It never happens in a vacuum. So unpacking people's story, right. You know, and yeah. Like being curious about that and like, not being willing to just, like, I don't know, put people in a bucket here right, or there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I kind of want us to close a little bit. Just, I got to get into this. I got to. Just the end. I have to. The faith-based part.
Yes.
You know, street chaplain. One, what does that mean? And two, I want to get a little bit of, like, how your faith has kept you driven, and what does that mean for our social justice, in which is can get a little, it can be a slippery slope with faith sometimes, and how do you corral and organize around that as well?
So my faith has been really important to me, and it's shifted a lot over the years, and it's, I would say, like, broadened a lot over the years, right? At Open Table Nashville, we're an interfaith group. So I'll talk about street chaplaincy first, I guess. I do that in an interfaith capacity, and that's really important to me. Like, the first some of the first people I actually married as a street chaplain were Wiccan women. They got married on the winter solstice, as interfaith chaplain. Okay. But, you know, I went to Vanderbilt Divinity School for Masters of Theological Studies, and I was so drawn to the caregiving work of chaplains, how they help people in major life transitions, like make their own sense of things, really mm-hmm. journey with them in some of the hardest parts of their lives, and do these really important meaning-making things for the community, like burials right. and marriages and things. Well, the people on the streets, our friends on the streets, so many of them do not feel comfortable in religious institutions or have been harmed by them. Mm. Specifically, our friends with the LGBTQI+ community and others. So, like, when they pass away, who buries them with dignity, right?
Right.
Who marries them the way they want to be married? Do they, like, who gives them access to these things that often to, you know, get that kind of holistic emotional spiritual care, mm-hmm. you have to have access to an institution.
Right.
So the idea was to take that same kind of care in a holistic sense to the streets and not have a gatekeeper of an institution, whether that's a hospital or a jail or a like church or something. And to really have this kind of like interfaith ecumenical ministry of presence and accompaniment, where you're deeply present mm-hmm. to the lives of people and how they're unfolding and the grief and the shame and the trauma. Mm-hmm. And also you accompany them in real ways.
Right.
And that means when they're like facing arrest at their camp right. because it's closing, then you put on your collar and you go sit with them and mm-hmm. you tell the cops, if you arrest them, you're arresting me. Mm. Like, that's accompaniment. And that's that kind of like practical solidarity
right.
that I think we tend in the South to focus on service projects.
Right.
We want to see people shift from just service to solidarity because that is when people put their own stuff on the line,
right.
learn and grow and have relationships of trust and mutuality.
And that's privilege and everything.
Yeah.
And so I got a question.
Yes.
Got another question. It's 2-in-1 type of thing. And when you brought up the LGBTQ community, it made me think about this. Do you see a difference of how our LGBTQ community and our community of color is served in that unhoused space compared to their white counterparts?
I mean, you're looking at Nashville, right? Southern city right. that always likes to act way more progressive than it is, mm-hmm. and is steeped in Christian, I would say Christian supremacy. Mm. So a lot of these service providers in Nashville are Christian.
Right.
Not all of them, right. but a lot of them that do work in the unhoused community. Like, for instance, our mission, our Nashville Rescue Mission. Mm-hmm. They have made steps in the last couple years to be more welcoming to trans folks.
Okay.
That has not always been the case. Mm. And there's still a lot of folks in the, and our friends in the LGBTQI plus community who do not feel safe there, mm-hmm. And who do not feel like they can sit through a Bible service right. just to eat and just to get a bed.
Wow.
So I would say no, people are not treated the same because mm-hmm. the service industry also is dominated. And this is the nonprofit industrial complex,
right.
which Open Table is a part of knowingly and trying to, we're trying to work ourselves out of a job.
Right. Yeah.
Like we do the advocacy work mm-hmm. because we understand that so many in the service providing community prop up the need for charity mm-hmm. instead of dismantling the things that make charity necessary.
Exactly.
So, but so much of the service industry in Nashville is white too.
Right.
There is an inherent white supremacy and there is an inherent Christian supremacy in mm-hmm. that work. So, so of course people are, and there are people who are black are disproportionately represented on the streets because right. of all the systemic things yeah. that have happened from right. redlining to slavery to all right. these other issues. Right. right. So.
How do you use your privilege and all of that as a white woman? To dismantle those things and be in solidarity, which I think is powerful, and I'm glad that you said it that way, because that's totally different when you're willing to give up whatever you have in order to also go to jail and be away from your family and you know, or whatever it may be, whatever benefits and privileges that you may have, you're willing to give that up for the moment in order to be alongside your comrade in solidarity so they can also feel the support.
You know, I've at our best, I've always seen Open Table Nashville as being this kind of hybrid organization mm-hmm. between service provider and movement organization. Uh-huh. That can really help bring folks in the service providing community, in the faith community, into more movement spaces. Mm. Kind of be like a gateway nonprofit to you know, I go into a ton of churches, I go into a ton of schools, and they're expecting some nice thing about, you know, homelessness and statistics and housing. And we're there to radicalize
right.
them and move towards solidarity and right. wherever they are. And so part of the privilege is whatever space we're granted mm-hmm. in. One of my roles as an educator is always trying to bring somebody who has experienced homelessness or, you know, who has been directly impacted
right.
To those spaces to have access. But then we radicalize people. Right. And it's a beautiful thing. And it really works. So we get into spaces that others might not have access to.
Yeah.
And we call people in.
Has there, like, what's like kind of like maybe the craziest response or like something maybe that like you threw somebody off because like they thought like, oh yeah, she's going to be here talking about homelessness and how we need to get people housing. And like you hit them with some radical fire and they like what has been like a response, like maybe like a subliminal like type of message, like, yeah, you probably won't be able to come back here, but you know, type of thing. Like,
oh, well, people have definitely walked out before our trainings and things, and like, oh my God, people have definitely walked out.
That's funny.
Most people are like pretty like, you know, polite. You just see their eyes moving or you see their head drop in the space and you see them start to look around.
I'm talking to you.
No. But you know, you do it in such a way that's so inviting and yeah. so disarming and right. so like you try to really meet them where they are and then take them that next step. So we really try to do that, but we've definitely not gotten invitations back. But we've also gotten the people like on the inside of certain faith communities mm-hmm. who say, I can't say this in our church, but you can. Mm. So can you come to this group wow. and say these things with your friends on right. the streets? Absolutely. Yeah. So we can play that role for people on the inside right. who feel like they don't have that voice too.
Personally, what has been maybe some of the challenges in, you know, your 20-year run at doing this work that you had to kind of just try to crawl, jump, scratch, or whatever. You had, what are some of those challenges like? And how did you pivot?
Exhaustion, like complete overwhelming burnout. I mean, when like burnout is such a serious thing, it affects every part of your life. Right. Like when you truly burn out. And I mean, I still struggle with anxiety from some of the work that I've experienced, struggle from vicarious trauma, secondary trauma from the work. We have to be real about how working in spaces and working toward change in a city, in a system that's not wanting that change, that wants to remain status quo,
right.
how it affects people's mental health in the movement community too.
Right.
You know, this work has completely depleted me and discouraged me and shown me the worst of humanity. And it's completely given me a purpose and been fulfilling and showed me like the absolute best in humanity. And so it's holding those things together, right?
Yeah.
And being real about how damn hard it is.
Right.
And how we see organizations and movement communities destroying each other.
Yeah.
And like, it is so, the transformative justice approach, and I'm following people and reading people like Adrienne Marie Brown right now, who talks a lot about this, and others, but that has a lot of hope for our movement communities too.
Yeah.
Who so easily destroy each other.
Right.
Instead of standing in solidarity and building and trying to transform.
Yeah, that indoctrination of just harm and punishment. Like.
And it's so, so devastating to see. But I mean, it's hard work to keep in. But the other thing I'll say is, you learn to do it in community because I cannot do this alone. You can't do this alone. None of us, the contributor, so having that community is really huge and crucial too.
Do you have a therapist or anything? Do you?
Absolutely. I have two.
No, I'm always curious, because I know it's like all of those things that you speak of, it just mentally, it's a lot to take in and internalize and compartmentalize and I just think it's you're human. You're the superwoman, but you're human.
Community.
Within community too, right? And I love to see when our amazing community of organizers and activists hey, look, I need a break.
Yeah.
I need to talk to somebody to, debrief what I'm going through. Because I think that just that lets the people who's looking from the outside in, he or she is just this is real life. This is we're not just doing it just to be doing it for self-gratification. It's we're really trying to help people and build community. Mm-hmm. And it's tough. And we have families and we're parents and, uncles and aunties and somebody's nephew and niece, all of that other stuff still comes with life.
It does.
Right. And we still want to give our best selves to them as well. Right. And so it's just always just curious and interesting. So I can learn too on pivoting some of the other things that others are going through and how they deal with that.
Yeah.
And just still just be able to do the work at a high level. So I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah.
Two more things. One, I want to get into this book a little bit. I want to just talk about Praying With Our Feet, Pursuing Justice and Healing on the Streets. Just give us a little bit of what's that about and how can people find that and support it?
Totally. So Praying With Our Feet came out in 2021 and it's really it's a memoir and even a spiritual memoir in some ways of the last decade plus of working not only on the streets but also on the front line of justice movements, right? Mm-hmm. And it's whether that's housing justice or being arrested at Occupy or doing campsite defenses or tenants' rights organizing and getting thrown out of slumlord apartments in Madison. There's lots of fun stories in there. But, you know, this idea, the book is anywhere books are sold. I really definitely love it when people go to like places like Parnassus or support independent mm-hmm. bookstores and buy it there whenever they can. But it's a fast read. It's really praying. The idea of praying with our feet came from a guy named Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel.
Okay.
Who was, you know, he had to flee Nazi Germany and Nazi Poland, Nazi occupied Europe. When his family was being killed, he came to New York here and saw the same kind of evils and segregation. Mm-hmm. So while he was marching with King in Alabama, he said, I felt as if our feet were praying and our legs were uttering songs. Mm. Like we were not, you know, praying, but we were like, this was a worshiping act
right.
together. And what I've learned to do is to channel the faith that I have and this hope of creating a more just world, creating, you know, what King called the beloved community or what I would call today collective liberation, mm-hmm. creating those things in the here and now and working toward them long term, that's a very spiritual work for right. me. And I draw on deep wells, not only within the Christian tradition, but I also draw wisdom from other traditions too. And I'm so thankful for that. But praying with our feet, that whole idea is, I have no interest right. when religion is self-serving.
Mm.
But when it works you know, in the Gospels, Mary talks about, the mother of Jesus talks about bringing down the low, like raising up the lowly and bringing down the proud from their thrones.
Mm.
This kind of beautiful shift, the last right. shall be first, right?
Right.
When religion and faith can move like that,
mm-hmm.
that's when I'm interested. And that's mm-hmm. when we don't just pray with our lips or with lip service to something,
right.
but with our whole bodies right. by embodying what we believe in, right. Like this more just society.
What do you feel that our faith-based community, whether that's brick and mortar, you know, churches and different denominations, or just people who just carry that themselves and claim to be, you know, religious or spiritual, what can that community do to better serve communities just throughout the world? Because we've seen, especially in the house, especially in the South, that, you know, churches were the pillars of the civil rights movement,
yes.
right? I don't know if that's the case so much anymore.
Most definitely
right?
Not.
and so, you know, what are some of the things you feel like the faith-based community can improve on in serving, you know, whether it's in the house or just communities that are just, you know, just suffering and with poverty and, you know, schooling and the lack of just resources, being neglected?
I mean, all people of mm-hmm. faith and conscience have a responsibility to work toward a better world for everybody in the here and now, not just some pie in the sky when you die, right? Or some like different afterlife or something. Like there's a responsibility here and now to our brothers, sisters, and siblings who are around us.
Right.
And when we're not using our resources, when we're not using our connections and our networks and our energy to bring about that,
mm-hmm.
Then we're actively complicit in the right. suffering around us.
Right.
So, you know, so many, there's so many things I want to say to this, and I know we're wrapping up.
get it off. You know, get it off. Yeah.
You know, every major religion has this concern for the poor mm-hmm. as a core tenet in their religion. What would happen if that wasn't just turned into service, but again was turned into solidarity mm-hmm. or was framed out with a justice analysis? Mm. And people actually came together to not just feed the hungry, but ask why they're hungry and actually start to change those systems.
Mm.
Not just by demanding more food stamps, but by right. creating the gardens in which right. can grow, by doing the land trust, by doing the housing co-ops, by doing like all these things that are going to create situations where people are more free. And we do see pockets of that. Again, like there has always, even in the worst times of human history, during the Holocaust, there were still churches who were the Underground Railroad there mm-hmm. for helping like folks who are Jewish flee and right. hiding them and right. like saying, if you take them, you're taking me too, and right. going to the gas chambers with them.
Right.
So there is this role of religious communities to stand in the face of injustice and say, like, we're all in this together, and if you take them, you're taking me. We've forgotten that, and we've thought all those things happened in the past and aren't still happening now.
Right.
But there's a civil rights song, and it was actually, I think it was first a minor song, Which Side Are You On?
Right.
Like, which side are you on?
Pick a side. There's like, no playing in the middle. You got to pick
like
a side.
Like, you can't be neutral in situations yeah. of injustice, so many people have said.
Yeah.
No,
you can't.
You cannot. So, you like, can't. When we're not active, we're complicit.
Mm.
How can we, you know, maybe we have the resource of money, maybe we have time, maybe we have energy. Whatever that is for us, we've got to figure it out and we've got to contribute it to the work of justice. And that's one of the things we go into those communities right. to try to
right.
light a fire in them about.
That was powerful. Man, that's wow. I want to ask you one question, then I'm going to give you the last word to close this out. The camps. How many camps do we have, like, in the Middle Tennessee area now, and what can community do to support those camps in the right way, the healthiest way,
yeah.
Holistic way for those community neighbors of ours that are living in those camps currently?
So the last time we actually did a count was years ago,
okay.
and it was over 200 just in Davidson County that we knew of.
Mm.
A lot of those are smaller, right?
Okay.
And a lot of those have been moved further out of sight of mind. We're seeing bigger pockets in Antioch and,
okay.
you know, Madison, Rivergate, Donaldson, all these other pockets that are still within the larger Davidson County, but Goodlettsville. So we're seeing more people spread out.
Okay.
What it's really important to remember is that people are living in those situations because we lack affordable housing.
Right.
The root cause of homelessness is the lack of affordable housing. Things like inadequate wages and racist systems and structure
yeah.
and all these other things go into that too.
Mm-hmm.
But the root cause is the lack of affordable housing. So, I mean, on a systemic level, wherever we are, advocating for housing,
okay.
wherever we are,
mm-hmm.
advocating for your landlords or other people to take a chance on folks
right.
and give folks a chance. And then when you see people living in camp situations, to get their names,
right.
ask how they're doing, try to support material needs whenever you can, especially when it's hot, especially when it's cold
yeah.
or when the elements are bad. It's so important to take people's physical needs seriously.
Mm-hmm.
and support where you can, and to provide things like, you know, if trash is a problem,
right.
they don't have garbage pickup like we do.
Right.
So, like, do they need trash bags?
Right.
Can you talk to Public Works and get a trash pickup for
right.
them? Like, we've done that.
Yeah.
So, like, little things like that, just remembering those things. And, again, being curious instead of judgmental
yeah.
about what people are having to go through.
We have a mayoral election coming up next year.
Lord help us.
If you could have our mayoral candidates, or if you could ask our mayoral candidates one question, right, around housing, give them something in mind and think about housing, what would that be? I give you a moment.
Oh my God, I don't even know. That's such a good question. I mean, I want them. Until there's housing for everybody, until they're actually having a plan that's going to build out housing at
mm-hmm.
capacity, I want them to come to every funeral we do, every funeral of somebody who dies on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to go to every camp and stay 3 nights in the winter and 3 nights in the summer and like get to know the people there and experience the condition. They don't get it. They're so insulated from
mm-hmm.
this. And because of the mayoral turnover we've had, we don't have a plan for addressing the 50,000 plus units of affordable housing that we're going to be short of by 2030.
Mm.
Like 50,000 units, that's enough to fill Bridgestone Arena twice. With, if you think about all the people, about 20,000 people can fit in Bridgestone Arena, like twice plus, right?
That's crazy. The
50,000 units of housing that we are short, and we will be short if nothing is done. So I don't want them to pay lip service. I don't want them to give us campaign promises that don't have legs and feet and teeth. I want them to really understand the suffering that people are facing and change their approach and actually get shit done. Because I'm so tired of mayors who talk about housing and the first thing they do is come in and cut the Barnes Fund. That's what Cooper did.
Well, you know, hey, that's a fact.
And I'm so yeah, I don't know. That I may have something different to say tomorrow, but today...
I thought I would just throw it out there. You know, try to get my head start, trying to figure this out. Look, I've enjoyed this. This has been powerful, amazing. I was excited for this. As I give all my guests, you get the last word to close us out. Whatever's on your heart, whatever's on your mind, for the listeners and the viewers to just take on with them. It can be around housing, it can be around just life, something spiritual, whatever you want to leave. I'm going to leave that to you to close this out.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about, we hear a lot about self-care, but I've been thinking a lot about collective care and what that can mean. And I've been experiencing a hard time myself, and I'm 3.5 months pregnant, and it's been a really rough road the last 3.5 months. So I've experienced people in a close community giving me care. But just this reminder to take care of ourselves, but take care of each other. And the more we can focus on, really caring for folks that are within our sphere, within our circle, whether that's on the median, having extra water and socks in our car for people, and like preparing to see people and give care and show care. Or whether that's, care and love on a macro level is equity, is justice. But I've just been leaning into this collective care piece and also remembering that, you know, maybe I'm an idealist. I've been called that several times, but another world truly is possible than what is here today. And we've got to lean into those things.
Got to manifest it.
Yeah. So wherever people are, like, have grace and care for yourself, knowing that we're all a work in progress. We're all learning and moving all the time. And try to channel that toward others that we see.
Well, thank you so much for just your time and your availability. And again, a whole bouquet of flowers to you in the community that supports you and that you support. Whatever we can do here at Deep Dish, you know, I think it's going to be some very tense times coming up that we're going to have to talk some of these things out. And, we're looking forward to be the primary place for that to happen. Because it's uncut, raw, whatever you got to say, you can say it in a brave and civil space. But thank you just so much for all the work that you and the community of Open Table are doing. And people, go support the book. Go support Open Table. Go support just our unhoused community. And just thank you again for your time. And we'll do this again sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. It's been so good. So good.